This week is a busy week, the family camp and the summertime. So it's good to see so many people here. And then the subject is love and compassion. So this is something that I think we're all interested in. Something that we all feel a need for, and also we need to learn how to do it ourselves, how to love and what we mean by compassion. And so these are, as I keep reiterating, that these are reflections. And I think it's very important just to keep in mind that this is the way I tend to talk is a reflective style. It's not kind of telling you anything. I'm not here to convince you or to convert you or to argue about the details of life, but more or less the idea of awakening and reflecting on our own humanity, on our experience of consciousness. And so this, we're so used to, say, modern education, where we are kind of given facts, figures, statistics, doctrines, beliefs, and ideas that can be very inspiring and very important to us. But the acquired knowledge that we get is not really from the awakened mind. It's, we adopt the views, the opinions, the ideals of other people, and through that we can feel a sense of inspiration, or we can feel a reaction of aversion or a rebellion or anger if you don't like what's being said or you don't agree. And the point of the talks of this type, reflections of this nature, are more for you to really look what's happening to you. So what I'm saying is how does it affect you? So you can kind of look at yourself rather than just kind of grasp what I'm saying and then agree or disagree with it. So, just being aware of what you agree with or don't agree with is like this. Whether you feel confused by what I say, or it makes you feel very confident or clear, or you feel definitely aversion to what I'm saying, or the way I say things, or whatever. It's all that I encourage you to do is be aware of what you are feeling. Because in the awakened, there's that sense of awakening, then this is our ability to pay attention to this being right here, which we call ourselves. And of course, the self-view in the worldly self-view is highly conditioned, because we have so many views, opinions about what we should or shouldn't be, or about what others should or shouldn't be, or how the world or the society or the family. And we hear it all the time in the mass media of this country, isn't it? All the opinions, views of how Britain should be and how it should go, how it should move, and how the Prime Minister should or shouldn't be, and on like this too. Our own personal relationships, family life, and that we tend to get caught up in these ideas and reactions without recognizing what's really happening to us, what's really taking place, the way it is. And so the Buddha was, this sense of Buddha or the awakenedness is pointing, is an encouragement to wake up and observe just the way it is. And of course this is what we use, we use this sense of awakened awareness or sati sampachanya, the awakened mindfulness, awareness, intuitive awareness. So these words are pointing to our ability to pay attention to this formation here, you know, so that we're beginning to recognize, say, what's going on in your heart or in your belly, or what, you know, how do you feel, or how do you emotionally, the way it is, rather than saying how you should feel or what you should believe in. Or, you know, if you were absolutely perfect, normal, healthy human being, you would totally agree with everything I say. And it's because you're neurotic and and this is intimidating, isn't it? Where I set myself up as the authority, and anyone who doesn't agree with me is somehow, you know, neurotic or misguided. So if I ever start thinking that, I pay attention to this, to my own kind of arrogance or demands on other people. And living in a community, like monastic community, you have every opportunity to do this, because the chances to get away with doing what I want to do at the expense of everybody else are very minimal here, because you've got to share your life with so many others. And so obviously in a community or a family, you affect each other in various ways, and this is just the way it is. It's just community life, being seemingly separate individuals with our own karmic tendencies, our own views and opinions, our own emotional habits, which can be very frustrating, irritating to others, as well as to ourselves, because most of us, I think the worst critic is yourself, is oneself. And I look at my life, I think that nobody has ever been so critical of me. I can't think of anybody that I've ever met or ever known that has been more critical and nasty to me than I've been. No, it starts here, and this is where this is what we can notice. You know, what each one of you is feeling right now and thinking and experiencing is mind boggles, you know. I don't have these high powers where I know exactly what the person over there is thinking right now. But I can be aware of what I'm feeling or thinking at this time. So it's reflective attention, paying attention, and mindfulness then is sati sampachanya, awareness, awakenness, attention. Then we begin to recognize or admit into consciousness pain, pleasure, feelings of desire or aversion or longing or loneliness or fear, anger, greed, whatever the conditions might be, without making any kind of critical judgment about it. So for example, if say monastic life, and say you have descriptions of what a good bhikkhu should be, and you read that and you think, I'm not a very good bhikkhu. because that's an ideal, isn't it, of the ideal of say like a Buddha Rupa or a ideal of the perfect man or woman. These are ideals. You can make them into perfect, you know, kind of images of perfection. But the way it is like this. So we begin to open and just notice uncritically, just willing to accept the way it is, which doesn't mean we approve or we like the way it is, but we can accept it. We can allow this moment to be what it is. Because ultimately we don't have any choice in the matter. If you don't like this moment, then the more you struggle against it, the more confused you'll become. Because at this time, at this moment, this is the only way it can be, because this is the way it is. But we also notice, as we begin to trust ourselves more and more with this intuitive awareness, we begin to see the changingness, notice that even though some mood or feeling might seem like a permanent obstruction to you, the way you hold it and identify with it, as you let go of it and accept it, then you see it's a changing thing. It has no center, no core. It's merely, as the Buddha described, foam on the sea, or like soap bubbles. There's nothing. When you see a soap bubble, if you don't know what it is, you might think if it's a big one, what a huge ball, enormous. But if you puncture it, then where did it go? And that's very much what we begin to recognize is our own feelings or thoughts, mental formations that we create as we begin to understand them and recognize them through accepting them. Then we are aware of their changingness. So this is the way of mindfulness that the Buddha kept encouraging us to trust in. And of course it's learning to integrate this in our daily life. Sometimes we present meditation as if you can only do it in a very formal way. You have to go on a meditation retreat, or you have to sit for hours, or you have to develop high levels of concentration, and then we grasp these ideas, and then we feel we can't do that in daily life. We've got family to take care of, we've got work to do. I don't have time to just sit for hours on a zafu in front of a Buddha image and practice samadhi, because the children start screaming and the neighbors play their radio too loud, and at work there's too much acrimony in the office, and I just have to try to control myself all the time. So the only place I can ever really be mindful is at Amravati on a meditation retreat. This view sometimes is not uncommon, because that's the way it seems. But recognize that awakened awareness is not dependent on conditions being any certain way. The Buddha was pointing to Nibbana, which is a realization of unconditioned reality in which the conditions are no longer the important issue. Whether they're good, bad, whether you're healthy or sickly, or your life is successful or failing or whatever, these are not obstructions to enlightenment, to seeing things as they are. Unless we believe that they are. If we're convinced and hold and grasp these things, then we've created an obstruction just through our own ignorance. So this awakened attention allows us to begin to stop creating ourselves endlessly in the same patterns and the same attitudes, and liberate ourselves from those habits that we've acquired in our life when we haven't understood the Dhamma, when we've merely operated from the habits, the conditioning that we have received so far. So this can seem like a very selfish kind of thing to be doing, just looking at yourself, and we could be spreading love to each other and compassion instead of sitting here looking, what am I feeling now? And so one can think, how does this inward look, this kind of introspection, or this attention inward, how does that relate to others outwardly? And of course, they, even in the different schools of Buddhism, they have great arguments about Theravada is usually the selfish school and Mahayana is the compassionate one. And so these are views that people form about the way they interpret maybe a particular teaching. And where does love come into it? And so some Theravadins, I remember years ago, some really hardline Theravadan Buddhists say, love is just lust and desire. and we have no time for love. I mean, but we're really getting to the, you know, into nothingness, into the unconditioned, and we're transcending those kind of weak, wishy-washy tendencies to that we might regard as love. But then love itself is a confusing word, and it's a powerful one. That's why we have to use it, because it's used in very vulgar ways oftentimes for greed or lust or desire. Loving to eat food or being besotted with somebody else, you know, we might think call this love. But when I use this word, I'm referring not to a kind of personal desires and preferences that I might have in regards to the conditioned realm, but pointing beyond that, because as you trust yourself more to awaken to life and understand yourself, then you find that the natural relating way of relating is through love. It's not like it's not a sentimental kind of thing. It's not depending on somebody being likable or doing what you like or loving me or anything like that. It's not the love that is easily destroyed if somebody you feel you are in love with starts persecuting you. So it's what we call unconditioned love, or it's a natural state that is natural to this realm when we begin to let go of our obsessions with the conditioned realm, with our identities, our infatuations with the conditioned realm, such as one's own physical body, or views and opinions or emotions, or the way we attach and want to others or to things, to people or places or things. We get very clinging and attached to various things that make us feel safe or secure or happy when we can hold on. But then that kind of love is always, always brings its opposite, because we know that whoever we love, you know, in this highly personal way, can easily turn against us or die or do something that will inevitably, we'll feel disappointed or betrayed by them. Or all the things we depend on, the places that we live in or the things that we have can be stolen or can be ruined in various ways. And we are always suffering grief or sorrow in the sense of loss, because what we depend on, what makes us feel secure and happy and fulfilled and make our life meaningful, can also make us feel depressed as we lose them, as these things disappear in our consciousness. Then we can only feel this despair or depression or resentment. So unconditioned love, then, and from this unconditioned love arises compassion. So when we talk about emptiness or the unborn or the unconditioned, it can sound like a bleak kind of annihilation where there's nothing, you know, and you just go into a blank state where, you know, you don't feel anything anymore. Or is it where love is manifests? So in regards to, in the Theravada system, we use these terms, the Brahma-viharas, which are sometimes translated as the divine abodes. The word Brahma itself is, in Buddhism, means heavenly or divine. And vihara is an abode, a place like we have the nun's vihara or the monk's vihara. So the Brahma vihara, the divine abodes, and of course the first one is the metta, or translated generally as loving kindness. Well, when you practice metta, not in a sentimental way, just by sometimes people think of metta as just thinking positively about everything. But metta is not a thought, it's an attitude of patient acceptance of everything. So in any kind of metta practice, first you direct it towards yourself. You say, may I abide in well-being, is how the first thing we say when we do this metta chant, may I abide in well-being. And so we're functioning very much on the convention of I am this being here. May I abide in well-being. So this is a convention of learning how to respect and accept who you are, whatever way you are. You know, which includes everything, your good side, your bad side, your weak side, your strong side. It's completely uncritical and unselective. It's in no way telling you how you should be or advising you on anything. It's just may I abide in well-being is an attitude of accepting and being patient and allowing what you're feeling, what physically, emotionally, mentally, to be, allowing these things to be what they are. So even if you don't like them, you're allowing them to be unlikable. You don't have to think of, if you start thinking about them, then you can get confused because maybe you don't like the way you are. So you want to be better than this, or you think you're not good enough. But even the feeling of being not good enough, accept that, without adding anything to it. So this takes patience and mindfulness and attention and this attitude of metta, which is accepting conditioned phenomena from the best to the worst, both internally in what we're thinking and feeling as an individual being, and then this generates outward to the world around us, the people we live with, the society we're in, the animal kingdom, the heavens, the hell realms. So we spread metta even to the demons and the devil. May the devil abide in well-being. So notice that this is what we call unconditioned love. There's no strings attached. There's no amount like spreading more, 90% up to the angels and 10% to the demons. It's not favoring even. So not having favorites or following your preferences. But it's this incredible ability we have to allow the world to be what it is. Then, of course, usually the reaction to this statement is, well, if we just allow things to be what they are, well, what's going to happen? You know, we've got to do something to kind of deal with the crime rate and the drug addiction and all the terrorists, and we can't just, you know, send love to them and accept them for what they are, because this is your thinking again. You're not practicing metta anymore. You started logically deducting from this something. because the logic is based on a dualistic structure, isn't it? So, you know, usually we think we have to annihilate, get rid of, punish, persecute all the bad elements in ourselves or in the society that we live in. And we can see how vengeful we are, how we want to somebody to, you know, not get away with bad actions. We should pursue them and try them and humiliate them and punish them for their wickedness. And then we do that to ourselves. So many people are guilt-ridden because they can never be as good as they should be according to the ideal. And there's a strong feeling of wanting to, maybe penitence is one expression of it, you know, to continually kind of bring up your faults and apologize and ask forgiveness and want some kind of forgiveness from others to make you feel that you feel better about yourself, because you feel that you shouldn't have, you shouldn't have said that, you shouldn't have done that, you shouldn't have thought that. So this metta then includes all of this. It includes even our self-righteous critical mind and our tendencies to want to get even, to seek revenge, to want forgiveness from others, because it's completely unselective. It allows things to be what they are. And so we don't have to think about them or pass any judgment, but acknowledge them. And the simple acknowledgement of, it's like this, the way it is. And the way it is isn't resigning oneself to a kind of mediocrity or just a kind of negative resignation to unpleasant conditions, but it's the way it is a reminder. Well, right now it's like this, and I accept the way it is. So it's a very real kind of acceptance, and accepting the totality of it rather than just bits and pieces. Learning to accept oneself the way we are. Is I think for many of us has been quite a struggle, because speaking for myself, the inner critic, I used to have this relentless inner critic that was always saying how I should be and how I shouldn't be, and so the way I am never seemed good enough, and so there was always this effort in my life to always improve myself in some way, because I never felt I was good enough the way I am. So metta then is learning to even accept the mental states that are weak or unwholesome or unskillful or stupid or downright malicious or evil, whatever they might be, including all the dull mediocrity that can come up in our consciousness, as well as our more inspired and kind of bright states and aspirations and ideals. Because metta has no preferences. It's not judging. So it's the word that we use to convey this ability we have to allow the conditioned world, which includes what we experience around us through our senses and what we experience within us as emotions or our instinctual drives or the physical body itself. So this is beginning to understand and to appreciate our humanity. our common humanity, in which we're not trying to make anything of it, trying to put it up on a pedestal or anything, but acknowledge it. Being human is like this. We've got these limitations in terms of this incarnation in this physical form. We've got these kind of emotional habits, whether they're, you know, all that wonderful or horrible or whatever, they are the way they are. Different characters, different ways of thinking, of looking, of experiencing the same thing. And this is not saying there's a better way or that you should think of it in any other way, but allowing yourself to open and allow whatever you're feeling to be conscious. And in a state of awareness, when you really accept life as it is, then you allow it into consciousness. You're not struggling, resisting it. So even fears, desires, anger, resentment, all these things will arise into consciousness, and the attitude is one of metta, allowing them to be the way they are. And through that allowance, then you can also begin to recognize that you're actually liberating them. As you allow something to be what it is, then its nature is changing, it's moving, it's rising, it's falling. And you're beginning to break down the illusion that it's you, that it's yours. And this is very important to break through this basic delusion that we all have, is I am this body, this is me, I am this person. I am these conditions, my feelings, my thoughts, my emotions. And even though this is what most of our society believes in, we live in a world that's committed to this view that we have of that I am this thing here. And so with mindfulness, we're beginning to see it not in that terms of I am this, but this is the way it is. These conditions are what I am experiencing right now. Anger or fear or boredom or resentment or dullness or stupidity or anxiety or confusion is like this. And then from that reflexive acceptance of it, what happens? Metta is a loving kindness that then is also around the conditioned realm, and since it includes everything, everything belongs. There's no longer this sense that things shouldn't be this way, or that that we've got to get rid of the devil. We've got to destroy the demons. We've got to recreate the world so that it's a perfect world with none of these negative forces in it. This is an ideal. So that's idealism, is where we're continually struggling to control and make things the way we think they should be. But in this awakened attention, we're noticing just the way it is. What is being human anyway? Being a human being. And we can see it in terms of weakness. Like usually people justify things they've done that aren't very good. And they say, well, I'm only human. So it's using the word humanity, the word human as a kind of excuse for not being perfect, for not doing everything properly, or for making mistakes. But being human isn't a matter of making a value judgment about humanity, but recognizing that that we're born in this form, this is what we call human form, human society, it's like this. And we're not ideals, we're not Buddha images, we're not perfect forms with perfect thoughts and perfect feelings and everything. This is not the way it is. That's the ideal realm. And so the human realm is like this. We have to live in this realm that is a continuous experience of irritating impingements. From the time you're born until the time you die, when you really look at your life, you have to deal with always this sense of something impinging upon you. Your sense, you see or hear, or smell, taste, touch. Your own karmic tendencies, your thoughts, your emotional habits, they're going on. Even though you might not like this is the way it is. This realm can be very beautiful, but it also can be equally very ugly. It can be blissful or painful, or it can be fair, it can be totally unfair. There's no way we can make it into the ideal world and society that we can imagine. But we're willing to accept life as we experience it. And then from that comes compassion, because we realize we're all in the same boat. We're all on the same planet, or all in the same universe. It's not just my problem. I mean, we've begun to recognize the suffering that we're all experiencing through not understanding things as they really are. And this allows us to relate to the suffering of this realm, not in some kind of arrogant way or patronizing way of feeling sorry for others, but much more a sense of real gut-level understanding of what it's like to be in this very sensitive state for a lifetime, having to live 60, 70, 80, 90, 100 years in this continuous kind of unrelenting, irritating realm that we're experiencing. So I just noticed that like having a physical body, and that there's always something not quite right about it. It's always, there's something irritating there, or either too hot or too cold. We're hungry or we're thirsty or we feel an ache or a pain or something. So there's always this is, or what we see can be, very unpleasant or here. Or even when we try to surround ourselves with just the sense world at its best, it's hard to control it, isn't it? Just to devote your life to only allowing yourself to experience beauty and totally rejecting anything that is not. And this is an impossibility, because this realm is this realm of change, birth and death, beautiful babies and getting old, and the changing conditions of growing up, adolescence, youth, middle age, old age, and so forth. These are the natural conditions that lead to death. So death is the result of birth, and death is around the condition, it's about the conditioned realm. Like we are all going to die, and we know that. We know that inevitably there's some time in the future where we're going to die, and yet sometimes we try to live our life without acknowledging that. I remember, especially when you're young, death seems so remote, so far away, that you kind of think you're going to be young forever. Youth is going to be an ongoing, long-term experience. And then suddenly, in your mind, you look back and say, it didn't seem to go by so. Where did it all go? The other day I was just young, and then. So, I mean, looking back from old age, you kind of think, you know, it's life goes by, one lifetime is not very long, it goes by very quickly. But these terms of time and lifetimes, these are other perceptions that we tend to never question and we tend to believe in. We never investigate. Just what is time as experience? And so the Buddha's pointing always to the present, to the here and now, which is timeless. As we begin to rest in the present, as we begin to recognize or realize this pure presence and begin to trust it and relax into it, then the perceptions of time are put into a perspective. Because we see all there ever really is as experience is here and now. That's all there ever is for anyone, any of us. It's always what's happening is happening right now. And the yesterday is a memory now, or tomorrow is a possibility now. But in terms of experience, it's always now. And so mindfulness then is this recognition, this allowing, this present, this now, to be, to really be with it, to be fully engaged with it, to be fully willing it, allowing it to be what it is. Because what we're feeling right now is the way it is. You know, it can't be any other way. It can only be this way. And we think, in the future, I don't want it to feel like this, and that's another desire, that in the future you'll do something to maybe get rid of something so you won't feel it again. But that's, you're experiencing it now, and the desire not to have it now. So then, what is it, or who is it, that's experiencing or is conscious and aware now? If there's no self, then what is it? You know, this is the ultimate question, really. This is the ultimate question. What is it that's thinking, feeling, and experiencing the limitations of this physical form right now? What is it that is speaking right now? What is it that's feeling right now? And so this, of course, is a question that leads to, you can't answer it in terms of forming an idea or a concept, but it's learning to awaken to the reality. You know, that's what Sati Sampachanya, it means really awakened. This awakened attention, this Sati Sampachanya, is the gate to the deathless, or it's the point, the present point, that is always now, always here, always now, wherever we are, whatever state we're in, it's always now. And we begin to let go of our passions for security in the future, or regrets or guilt about the past. We begin to see the futility of worrying and endlessly trying to gain all kinds of a sense of security for our future, or fears of being persecuted because of, punished for things we've done in the past. We begin to let go of all these tendencies towards a more trusting and a really peaceful sense of pure presence. Now, since this is available to all of us, every human being on this planet, you know, so, I mean, this is where we begin to lose this sense of separation and identity with race, for example, or with gender, or with class, or with ethnic conditioning. Because these, you can see how many problems there are now in North Ireland and in Israel and all over the world. Is people just so strongly clutching at their identities, which always bring them into some kind of opposition to something else. You know, so because your identities are always with what you're not, with the things that make us different. What makes you and I different on the condition level then become real to us. And because your differences aren't completely kind of simpatico with mine, then I feel threatened or angry or prejudiced or biased towards you, because I'm limiting myself always to my own view, my own conditioned attitude, my own bias. But as we let go of that, then what's left is what we call the reality of the deathless, or the unborn, uncreated. And that you can't conceive of. You have to use words like negations, you know, like unborn and things like deathless and whatnot in order to deal with it, because the reality is so here and now, so completely here and so real. And yet we're bound to the illusions through our not being awake, not paying attention, not recognizing the way things are. I find that it's quite encouraging to see how much interest there is now in things like meditation in countries like this, because I think more and more of us are feeling this, somehow a kind of that we've reached a dead end on a cultural level. And just trying to improve the society endlessly seems to be, you know, it's never good enough. No government will ever elect in this country will ever be good enough for us. And even if it's really good government, it'll not be good enough. Because that's the way it is, because there's always something wrong. In this realm, if you have good, you have bad. If you have day, you have night. When you get one, you get the other along with it. So this sense of deathlessness, or the reality of deathlessness. Now, since you can't conceive it, you can kind of abstract it into a word like deathless. But the reality of it is what you're beginning to realize or recognize through awareness. The more you develop and cultivate this way of awareness, and you really look at yourself in an accepting way, non-judgmental, but acknowledging. It's very honest, very direct. It's not trying to justify or whitewash anything that you're feeling. It's totally this attitude of metta totally accepts even the most miserable state of mind or feelings, or the most nasty kind of feelings are accepted because you're allowing them to be what they are. And through that allowing, through that engaging, through opening to life and recognizing and realizing this, then you have this realization of the deathless. the unborn, which is an intuitive reality. It's so here and now, so real that we don't see it when we're caught up in just habitual behavior, just habits and thoughts and our own views and opinions, identities, blind us to this reality. So it's through this opening to life that these obstructions we create, these desires, these fears, these habits, we can allow them to be what they are, and their nature is to cease. Everything, every condition, good or bad, right or wrong, takes us to this ultimate reality, if we allow it to be. In Buddhist meditation, we have, like, generally referred to as vipassana. This, of course, is, this can be, I mean, a lot of techniques that people use called vipassana. But what it really means, like when we talk about the four foundations of mindfulness, or the satipatthana, or vipassana, these are kind of skillful means the Buddha used or taught, which help us to start, to encourage us, to give us some sense of, some kind of direction. So notice with meditation you're starting to look inward, but it's not to shut everything out, but because most of us are always pulled outward. We're so reactive and so caught up into the society that we're living in. And the senses, you know, they're always, we see something or hear something, smell something, we're always reacting to its quality. And so this, and if we just operate on that level, then of course we get increasingly more conditioned by it. We become very, fussy and difficult as we get older because we've just got to control things in order to not feel too confused or distressed by our life. So this openness, this sense of relaxed attention, like oxymoron, isn't it? A relaxed attention, is a being at ease of allowing even your physical body to accepting it the way it is, allowing your physical condition, even if you have sickness or pain or whatever, allowing it to be the way it is, relaxing with it, not just endlessly struggling, resisting, fighting, trying to, or ignoring, or criticizing, or blaming. This takes a determination, doesn't it? To accept just the limitations of our physicality. Because the modern life is very much the idea of being an individual, what we look like, what we wear, and all these things. Put so much attention to the ideal figure, you know, the perfect form. That are presented to us, and then the kind of way we endlessly criticize our own bodies because they're not that good. And if they are, they don't stay that way for very long. And then they're always struggling with this. Then the ideals of that we have of being a success, isn't it? We all like to feel that we're respected and successful and that we're worthy. You know, we've proven ourselves that we are somebody. You know, we're not just a nobody, just anybody. We're somebody. And this thing is, but then when we, even when we become somebody, still totally unsatisfactory. So whether you're nobody or somebody, it's pretty much the same thing. It's not anything to you develop, you know, to use your life to try to prove that you are somebody, because it'll be a terrible jip at the end of your life. So the encouragement is to this awakenness. And this, we can all, this is our potential as human beings, and the potential of all human beings. So what this does for me when I reflect on it, then I look at humanity now as that awe in this way of in all this potential for enlightenment, rather than seen in terms of rich, poor, African, Asian, European, or American, or anything like that, or the good and the bad. You can see even in the most detestable criminals and serial killers the potential for enlightenment. And that, of course, allows for compassion, because you see the sadness of a life wasted, of somebody who's never awakened, who's lived always in some kind of painful state, and through maybe unskillful ways of living, and through incredible selfish obsessions and malicious acts and so forth, have created an endless realm of pain and misery for themselves. And yet they too have this potential. So then you realize you don't really have to punish anybody, because we end up punishing ourselves anyway. Say, maybe we should open all the prisons, and then everybody go, no. But like capital punishment, things like this. To me, this is, for a Buddhist, that's a bad karma, because it's like, if you're hanging a criminal who's a murderer, you're actually committing murder yourself by murdering them. And we don't look at it. We don't want to recognize that our government is actually murdering somebody. We call it capital punishment, we call it. Because we don't call it capital murder, you know. That's not the right word. That we don't want to recognize it as that. But in terms of this lack of compassion, isn't it? A sense of revenge, of making them pay the price. This of course, is from our dualistic mind. And we can all, and I understand that too. I can certainly, on one level, my conditioned personality, some terrible criminal who's done terrible things to others, and you know, when they catch them, and I can certainly feel they should be punished. They should be made to feel the pain that they've caused to others and get into a very self-righteous state. But awareness of this, I realize, is not something I believe in or would grasp or want to follow, because it's creating suffering for me. To wish harm upon somebody else is... And to hold to that wish is, I'm creating suffering for myself. I'm harming myself. So now I see Khun Lada has brought the tea out on the server. Very good. You can always depend on her. You don't even have to ask her to do it. She does it quite independently. And so we can have a break for tea, and then in about 20, 30 minutes, we can, for those who wish to pursue this further, we can have a discussion.